Log Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. This is Ellie Steele. Sorry I started a little late tonight, if anybody was waiting. Tonight I'm going to continue where we left off last week, my reading of the finding of the third eye. And I found that this book to be fascinating. I mean, I don't know if it's still, I kind of doubt if it's still in print. I don't know if you can get a copy. George Dixon was the lent me this book recently, and I've been more than fascinated by it. And it really is. It's the first book I've ever read that really starts to get into the concept of the third eye, and that not so much the third eye, but the fourth dimension. You know, and that is something that has always amazed me. I've always been somehow felt a part of it, called to it. I don't understand exactly what that means, but I really don't know why it fascinates me so. But you know, most people live in the third dimensional reality and never break out of the box. But when you try to break from that third dimension, or when you suddenly are broken away from it, either through death or taxes, you have a tendency to what's happened is you've gained an insight, a remarkable insight that into something that you can't quite comprehend. It's something, as you understand the fourth dimension, or operating in the fourth dimension, which is something that I'm beginning to understand more and more as I read, study, and experiment, I have found that the fourth dimensional reality does exist. There's no question in my mind about that, as does fifth, sixth, and seventh, and so on. And the more I read about this, the more I hear there are harmonics or overtones within those different planes. And I've come to an understanding of things that exist that I never really comprehended before, not in the same way where you actually can experience fourth dimensional existence. I know that sounds strange, but I know, Leo, you're going over there tonight, but I'm not, and I'm not really, because as people who follow my show know, I go off on tangents now and then, and but I do try very hard to bring a relevant information, good, solid information, on the areas that I'm studying. And my life is a constant study. I can't help myself doing it. I can't help myself but read and write and develop a greater understanding toward these things that pique my curiosity. And the concept of the fourth dimension has always been, how can I say, it has always been the air. In subtle, in different ways. And it's difficult for me to explain actually how I feel about it, and I know it's unusual for anybody to be out here talking about this subject, but hey, you know, that's what I do. And you know, if you love it or leave it or don't care about it, it doesn't matter to me. The fact is, I'm here and I'm talking about it so that somebody who's also interested in this might get something out of it and further go further to find these remarkable mysteries. And Again, I'm reading from The Finding of the Third Eye by Vera Stanley Alder, A-L-D-E-R. And absolutely remarkable book. Very difficult in the sense that you have to put yourself there. You have to kind of be a believer in a way before you can accept the concepts in this. But it's well written, and it's well written. It's a very unusual book. It's like a self-published thing, but it's really not. It's put out by Health Research, Monk Loom Hill, California. M-O-K-E-L-U-M-N-E Hill, California. And it was published in 1960. There's not even a copyright page really to speak of here. Self-published. It looks like it's self-published, doesn't it? It's curious. If you would like to, I really wish somebody could get a copy of this if you're really interested. It says Masonic books and related subjects. These books are facsimiles reproduced by Health Research. Nothing left out, not condensed. Cardboard covers, always in stock. Spiral bindings. 15% discount, only 25. But it's like, yeah. It's really hard to say, but it's not. It's very esoteric, and its cover and everything is very, very old, very weird. But nevertheless, it's something you should something fascinating. A fascinating book. And I'm going to. I read in chapter 1 and 2 last week, and I think I'd like to continue on chapter 3. I've read this myself since, but what it says here is more most important. And for my listeners, I would be really remiss not to talk about this. And this is chapter 3. Having studied our world according both to, the chapter 3 is called The Secret Knowledge. Having studied our world according both to the modern matter of fact scientist and the less orthodox modern ideas, let us now turn and plunge into the past and see what our ancestors knew and how their knowledge helped them. They prophesied the long dark age of ignorance, in which we are at present emerging. That ignorance has engendered in us the habit of scoffing at everything which is not ordinary, normal, or able to be weighed and measured by scientists. The scientists themselves have reached a point where they are no longer dealing with purely physical or chemical things. They have pushed upwards through the great scale of vibrations until their heads are in the clouds of conjecture. And perhaps they dare not speak of the possibilities they conceive. Now, I wanted to mention that this book was written in 1960, but, I mean, it's very, very relevant to today, 40 years later, or actually 50 years later. Let us leave them hesitating in that exciting position and start a tour of exploration of our own. Scientists themselves have reached a point where they are no longer dealing with purely, in a universe full of trillions of stars, of constellations and solar systems, there is one minute, little revolving speck of matter which we call Earth. This speck of matter is covered with millions of microscopical creatures called human beings. And the strange thing is that these microscopical creatures consider themselves important. Each minute one of them is able to feel that he is more important than the whole universe upon which he is but a speck. Are these creatures really important? And if so, why? Looking at them dispassionately, we could see that there is at least one remarkable thing about them. Almost any one of them, by training his microscopical brain, is able to visualize the past, present, and future, not only of his own little person, country, or planet, but of the whole universe. Within his tiny personality, there is locked a power which will give him unlimited understanding of things quite beyond his physical reach, a dynamic capacity to weld the forces of nature with a mind of which he knows not the limits. Man is an animal, but he is an animal embodying a god. The ancients were much more alive to his potentialities than we are now. As we explore, it will take us some time to decide whether man knew more thousands of years ago than he does today, and whether he was a finer being. This planet is infinitely older than most of us imagine, and so is the history of mankind. Archaeologists are continually having to push back their dates further into the past. Much learned in history books by the last generation is obsolete and must now be unlearned. Civilizations had been rising, falling, and disappearing eons before the men who owned the Paleolithic skulls were born. All these things are revealed to us in the Ancient of Secret Wisdom, or Secret Wisdom, which is a collection of teachings handed down from the very earliest times, explaining man, his origin, his composition and destiny, and also the purpose of the universe. This wisdom has come to us in unchanged form, concealed and taught throughout the world under the garb of many of the ancient religions. We will trace this in a latter chapter, but begin now by a study of the wisdom itself as it is seen, or rather, as it is still to be found in the East. This teaching professes to expound to us the few great fundamental laws upon which are founded the life and progress of man and the universe. Let us endeavor to shake off the habits of thought imposed upon us by the generation of a dark age, and consider with an open mind the heritage bequeathed to us by our earlier ancestors. The great laws can best be named for us in English as follows: repetition, evolution, cause and effect, or karma, and rebirth. And number four is the plan of creation, or the seven planes. Let me repeat that. The great laws can best be named for us in English as follows. Number one, repetition, the microcosm and the macrocosm. Number two, evolution. Number three, cause and effect or karma and rebirth. Number four, the plan of creation or the seven planes. The principle of the first of these laws is, as in the microcosm or man, so in the macrocosm, the universe. It asserts that the same systems of form, time, and motion runs through the whole universe, so that if we properly study an atom or a cell, we will obtain the keys to the working of a man, a planet, or a constellation. In that way, through a knowledge of periodicity, or the regular periods of a time, which occur on a small scale in nature, the ancient mathematicians were able to calculate the stars, their movements, and thereby the evolutionary stages in history, or large scale, and to prophesy conditions and influences thousands of years ahead. And we've talked about this extensively, George Dixon and I and Lila, and, discussing the Mayan calendar and the Mayan prophecies. And you can go to many of our programs, to check that out. I mean, they're all in our archives. It is disconcerting to find that the conceptions of the very ancient sages tax the modern man's mind to the utmost. Even to understand their meaning and visualize their ideas takes effort and practice. Much less could modern man originate such profound theories himself. And the ancients accomplished these things without, so far as we know, any of our modern mechanical aids. This great law of repetition declares that there is an ordered arrangement within the universe, with certain periods of time and patterns of form repeated up the scale and governing the tiniest to the greatest. It asserts that the little things are a mirror of the larger ones, and everything is not only a replica, but intimately connected with everything else. For instance, if you want to study a solar system, you can study an atom. And if you want to study animal, plant, mineral, or even solar life, you will find it all represented in the body of man himself. Man, know thyself, was the ancient command written above the temple door. If we persevere with the fascinating study, we will find that in the form of every human, we can impact the solar system with atoms. The world, in its most active and creative form, is his interior labor story. Interior laboratory, and the physical development of animal life from its lowest to its highest form is his embryo. In his nature, we will find a mixture of the passions and peculiarities of all living creatures. We can also trace an intimate relationship with all the planets through the interplay going on in his body with the cosmic and planetary rays, and a connection with his mind, with the highest unseen cosmic intelligence, the mind of nature. This first great law, then, that of the microcosm and macrocosm, give us at once a much more comprehensive outlook on life, and therefore the capacity of bringing vision and breath into our creative work. The second great law is that of evolution. Everything in life is evolving upwards and onwards to a higher and more perfect state, having had its beginning in an uncreative, unconscious, and elementary form, and growing and progressing through striving, sacrifice, and struggle to a condition of creative self-confidence, potent strength. Beginning at the lowest end of the scale with the minerals, we know that they have an elementary consciousness or mentality, that they strive, struggle, and become tired, and they are sacrificed to or absorbed by the kingdom upon them, the vegetable kingdom which lives upon them. The vegetable kingdom has a higher consciousness or vibration than the mineral kingdom, and a greater power for struggling and adapting itself. In its turn, it is sacrificed to the animal kingdom to feed upon it. The animals may seem to the plants to be some kind of deities, while wonderful, and to them miraculous powers of movement. The sum of vegetable and mineral experience is absorbed by the animals who depend on this for their life and evolution. In return, it is said that the animals provide, by their breathing, the carbon dioxide upon which the plants exist during the day. And some of the animals are becoming extremely advanced in consciousness and are full of what can be described as spiritual aspiration. Mankind are their deities, and they strain and strive to attain, in such things as speech and work, to the miraculous activities of their gods. And the adoring eyes of a dog and his efforts to talk, and the keenness and pride of an elephant at work, are instances in point. Animals are sacrificed in every way to man, who uses them to the utmost. He absorbs the sum total of mineral, vegetable, and animal experience into his body, and depends upon their qualities for this life and evolution. In return, he can teach and care for them and aid them immeasurably by his love and example. We continue up the scale and find that in the kingdom of man, the same process is going on. The more advanced type of human being is sacrificing his lower nature and striving to reach and copy a higher kingdom of beings than his own. He calls these beings angels, gods, or deities, and has as much difficulty in understanding their wonderful capabilities as the animals have in understanding his own. But just as the animal depends upon man for the final development of their intelligence, so man depends on the subtler and more inspiring minds of the angels for his own awakening. We are told also that just as man depends on his sustenance and progress upon the lower kingdoms of nature, so the angel world depends upon the offering and sacrificing of man's soul force for its own nourishment and development. Mankind and the angels can only reach greater heights of realization through the interplay of mutual service. In accordance with the first great law of repetition, we realize that the process must continue, and therefore we are bound to infer that the angels are also sacrificing to and striving to reach a higher kingdom of being than themselves. The ancient wisdom was mapped out for us the pattern of these angel communities and hierarchies. An amazing vista of worlds ahead of us is thereby opened up for our consideration. The third great law of the karma and rebirth. This states that nothing in life is wasted, and all things share alike the chance of regaining ultimate perfection and of going through the full course of experience and development. We see that in the physical world, as soon as a plant or other living creature has had its particular span of life, it dies or withers. The cell which formed it degenerate, but their chemical constituents come together at a later period to form a future plant or animal, closely resembling the former one, but plus always a stage of further adaptability and change, showing that the consciousness and memory of the former plant has been reborn too. And you know that what I really enjoyed reading this, and it's probably the first time I've ever really seen these words affirmed in writing in such a definitive manner. You know, it always seems to be some vague doubt that this remains in the writer's conviction, but I don't think I've ever read this next to maybe Emerson and possibly Thoreau. I've never seen a conviction so great, you know, as I've seen in this for these universal powers, understanding and believing in these universal powers, and the logic behind it is so brilliant, really, that it surely, to me, it personally explains the great, many of the great, you know, it explains the basics of our existence, what it is, what the great laws are, and how we operate. I'm going to repeat them again because they're so important. Is repetition, the microcosm and the macrocosm, evolution, cause and effect, or karma, and rebirth. And fourth is the plane of creation, or the seven planes. And we'll get into that seven planes, Bob, I hope, tonight, because it's a fascinating subject. Kind of lost my place here, so wait just a minute. Ancient wisdom has mapped out for us the pattern of these angel communities and hierarchies, and an amazing vista of a world ahead of us is thereby opened up for our consideration. And I want to refer people to back to my my works on my they're in my archives now, but back to my reading of the Agni Yoga series. And we talk about one of the books in the Agni Yoga is the Hierarchies, and it was an amazing book because one of the books of the series, because of the it explains the hierarchies of in the multi-level, the multiple dimensions that are above us, and how they speak to us. How these angels, or these ascended masters, actually, they say angels that are really ascended masters, people who have experienced this world and have gone further and further and further beyond until they, they eventually totally forget this world. But in the fourth dimension, you're just coming out of this world. You're just learning to think and act like a non three-dimensionally, you know, and that's very difficult, and that's why this book is so interesting, because it teaches us how to utilize our third eye, which is our pineal gland, and it teaches us how to see life through that third eye, and once you start to perfect that vision in that third eye, it takes on a whole different perspective. Life takes on a whole different meaning, a whole different perspective. You realize that what you're here for. You realize purpose. You realize desire. You realize needs. You realize what these things are all about. What they are, and. Now, it's not just a big hodgepodge of chaos, but it actually, through the third eye is designed to see through, cut through the crap and the chaos and of the third dimensional existence and forcefully and see the fourth dimension, be aware of that fourth dimensional space, a plane, if you will, the fourth dimensional plane. Constantly, so that once you tap into that, you'll never tap out of it. You're always there. You can tap back in, come back to Earth every so often, but once you're there, you never really want to leave it, because life is too good there. And life doesn't have the same boundaries that life in the third dimension does. We have no boundaries in the fourth dimension. Fourth dimensional existence is one of pure manifestation of desire. Whatever you desire, you can manifest immediately. There's no space or time continuum. No space, no time. That, as we know it. It's instant. It's an instant gratification. Whatever you desire, you'll have. So, in other words, once you find your way, struggling through the third dimensional existence, you get to a point in your life where you understand. And some people retire, and others just say, "Well, no, I don't want to retire." And some people retire, and as they retire, they've gone through their third dimensional phase of suffering and work and all this kind of stuff. And now they've saved and they've whatever, but what they don't understand is that in an artificial way they're seeking a third dimensional, fourth dimension, and that doesn't exist. And you can't have third and fourth dimension together. It just doesn't. You have shadows of each, like for instance, once you're in the fourth dimensional state. You have their shadows of your shadow is your third dimensional existence. Once you're in the third dimensional state, your shadow is your fourth dimensional existence, you see. So, in the fourth dimension, you never forget the third dimensional state that you lived through, but you become adjusted to the fourth dimensional existence where life is so much better, and the mind is so much freer, and your body is freer, and everything is freer, and just has a greater capacity for love and for peace and for happiness than it ever did before. And you don't understand why people in the third dimension are fighting and warring and so ignorant of their own selves. And this is what great masters have tried to teach us over the millennium. Christ and Buddha and, you know, Lao Tzu and Muhammad and Paul of Tarsus and Christ, you know, because of their, when a person reaches the level of martyrdom, let's say for their religion or their cause or whatever it may be, they've in some way have already energized their bodies to the level, to the maximum, to allow them to destroy themselves. And either in protest or is a weapon of war or, you know, or whatever. Well, the difference is that, you know, when the mind has such a remarkable capacity to expand on these thoughts that that everything we do can become is essentially spiritual in nature. And so just by tapping into the fourth dimensional reality, understanding that it actually exists, and then being aware of what it is and how close it is to you, it's there. I mean, you don't have to travel light years to get there by jet engine, you know. You have to, it's there. It's immediate. It's in your mind. And all you have to do is just rise to the level where you can open that door and just allow your mind to absorb that fourth dimensional being, fourth dimensional state. I have a difficulty explaining it further, and that's why I'll go back to the book. But once you tap into that source, and I say source, but it's actually into that intelligence, into that concept, and you can. And then it shatters the glass of your the glass ceiling that you self-imposed, okay, on has been imposed upon you by your religions and philosophies and so on. And once you've shattered that, then you're no longer bumping your head, you know, as you rise. You got to think of yourself as a helium balloon or as a balloon, and knowledge is the helium. Knowledge is the gas. Knowledge is the element that makes you rise, want to achieve greater, learn more, you know, develop greater skills, greater understanding, greater comprehension. And once you've developed that, it's like a helium balloon rising until suddenly it stopped, and it stopped by the glass ceiling. That glass ceiling to infinity is man-made religion, right? Man-made philosophy, simple-minded philosophies or archaic philosophies that perhaps don't apply whatsoever to our current life. And yet, every great thinker or every modern thinker wants to be able to use some other thinker's thoughts to advance his own. However, I think it was Newton that said that he stood on the shoulders of, when he was on the gravity tower, he said that he stood on the shoulders of geniuses, of giants, and that was Galileo and Copernicus and great master, great Greek and early medieval men of science and imagination who discovered the world is round and not flat. I mean, you know, can you imagine discovering that the world is round when everybody in the world says it's flat? And they're going, wait a minute, you know, this doesn't make any sense. How can this world be flat if everything around us is round? You know? And then you get into the understanding of sacred geometry, and you get into the understanding of how the earth is created and that the universe is created. And we see God in everything in the third dimensional, but we see the face of God as a painting, if you will. Some artist interprets in rendition, right? Well, and so that gives us an image and an idol to divert our devotion to, and worship, and that's wrong, because God, if you go back to the earliest commandment, back to the Egyptians, which is their Ten Commandments were the same as the Ten Commandments of the Jews, virtually identical. And those early commandments stated, thou shalt have no other God before me. That's the number one thing in the Ten Commandments, and also in the Egyptian commandments, which were done several thousand years prior to the commandments given by Moses. So these commandments of Ihotep and then later on Moses, or some could say that Ihotep and Moses were one and the same, which could be, because they very well could be, because the written laws that Moses supposedly crushed or broke were, you know, the same. The Ten Commandments were the same, and as the Egyptian Ten Commandments. So, based on that, we find that the one God, and that's the one God that we trust now, right? When the one God that we believe in, or that I believe in anyway, is the one and the same God, okay, of the early, you know, of the Egyptians, and the same God of the Israelis, or I should say Israelis, but the early Jewish people, and at the same time, the same God of the Christians and the Muslims. But over time, religion has managed to put restrictions upon man in his ability to speak to God and to directly communicate with God. Man does not need middlemen. I don't need a middleman to talk to God. You know, I don't need some pedophile priest to tell me how to talk to God, or some criminal evangelical Momo on television to tell me to give him some bucks. You know, I don't need that crap. You don't need that crap. Nobody needs that kind of crap, all right? You know, and that's why now, in the sixth night of the Thayan calendar, religions are being destroyed. The Catholic Church is destroyed. The Protestant Church is useless. You know, all religions are seeing themselves exposed for what they are, which is primitive, nihilistic crazies, okay, running around, calling for the end of the world and craziness, you know, and absolute insanity, all right? No, that's not what's happening. That's not what's happening. Based on the ancient writings, that is not what's happening. What's happening is we are ascending. We are ascending in our evolutionary process as human beings to a higher level of existence. And that level is the fourth dimension. That's where we're headed. That's why we don't understand what's going on. That's why we're having difficulty trying to comprehend anything that we see or do or feel. We're losing touch with reality. with the third dimensional reality, and we are arriving and ascending without our. And the thing is, it's not because we're trying. It's just happening. It's happening. And unless you understand that it's happening, regardless of how you fight it, all right, then you must relax and let it happen, because it's a really pleasurable experience, a wonderful experience. It's one that's built entirely on faith, entirely on pleasure, well-being, the wholeness of the spirit, brotherhood, eternal love and peace and unity. It's not built on vengeance and death and destruction and hatred and, it's not built on any of that. That's the waste. Consider that the waste product of the fourth dimensional existence. We want to shed that. We want to eliminate that from ourselves. We no longer have that in us. And if we can do that, and I'm telling you, it's not easy to do. It's not easy to do. I haven't done it, but I'm working on it. I haven't been able to eradicate my dislike and hatred, if you will, for evil, my hatred for people that incarnate evil. I have that. I can't help it. I can't love my enemies. I just can't. I cannot do that. To me, I don't believe that Christ said that. He didn't love his enemies. He felt pity for them. But he cast them out as fast as it is. He saw evil in the pigs, and he cast the pigs, they cast the spirits out, and the pigs jumped over the cliff. Okay. He saw in the fourth. He lived in the fourth, fifth dimensions, and he saw this evil. He saw the spirit being possessed. Of human beings. He saw them writhe in pain and misery and fear of death and loathing and leprosy and all these diseases, and because of the crippling of the mind, because of the isolation and of people and the remote and the ignorance, and illiteracy and pathetic existence of so many people living an abject pagan poverty, that like a being like Christ would walk among these people and look at them and feel horrible compassion for them, because it's a God, you are God's people, you are one, just believe in God, turn yourself, believe as I do that God exists. Become God's children. You are God's children, just like I'm God's son. You are God's son and daughters. And once you understand that, once people get into their mind that they are God as well, representatives of their Creator, then there's no limit to what they can achieve, because that is what. Then they accept the aspect of co-creationism. They say, yes, God gave me the power to create. So. I can create whatever I want. I can create my misery, or I can create my joy. I can create my pain, or I can create my pleasure. I have the power to create. So why am I feeling like I'm imposed in slavery here? I don't need to be imposed in slavery. I don't need to be this way. All I have to do is think myself out of this, right? And if I think myself out of this by doing the least amount of damage to somebody else, but If I have no reason, no fear whatsoever to kill somebody in self-defense, if that somebody is trying to kill me, and I don't care how much love you push at that person, they're still going to kill you. And personally, pal, I like my life. I don't want to get shot. So you try to negotiate your way out of it. You try to talk your way out of it. You try to reason with the person. But if that demonized, that possessed person is, and I say possessed because that's essentially what they are, possessed with hatred and possessed with ignorance, and these are demons, ignorance, hatred, sloth, you know, just stupidity, you know. These are the vilest of the vile qualities of human nature. And yet, for us to embrace these people, forget it. I'm not going to embrace that kind of element in my life. I'm not. I do not need to. It's like Christ said, don't throw your pearls to swine. Why? I could talk all night till I'm blue in the face to a blue-collar Republican neocon Neanderthal, right? Wouldn't change his idea in the world because the guy's not bright enough to change. The guy's not bright enough. I mean, he's, you know, but who knows? Maybe he might be. But I'm not going to go down to the pits, okay, and have a pissing match with that person, all right, to save his soul. Forget it. He doesn't want to save it. I don't want to save it either. You know, he doesn't want to have a good life. That's his problem. Maybe to him, a good life is a can of beer and a lousy television show, a rerun of Andy Griffith or something. Maybe that's happiness to him. And if that's happiness to him, God bless him, let him go. But that's not happiness to me, and that's misery. That's a form of hell to me. And if I, you know, I can't do that. So, you know, I move along and on my own quest. And I don't feel people should be held accountable for moving along, for moving on. We are given our own lives. We're given our own short lives to live, whatever they may be. And believing in karma, as I do, and believing in reincarnation, as I do, I believe that life, we are put here for a purpose, or we come back to achieve a purpose and then move on as quickly as our job can be done, and then move on to the higher light, move on to the fourth dimensional phase of our existence, okay? And possibly, and then higher into the fifth and sixth and seventh and so on. And we move on to the seven planes of existence, which I didn't have much time to talk about tonight. But if I can just say before I go too far, laws. we are told that all of life is built upon the law of opposites, as in the negative and positive poles of electricity, day and night, heat and cold, summer and winter, good and evil. The constant friction between these opposites causes development, change, adjustment, in other words, originality, or the free will which functions throughout all creation and through which creation itself learns inevitably to become creative. All this happens so slowly to us that at times we do not realize that there is progress, because we become confused by the backward crouch of the wave of progress before a further push forward. Probably we are living at a time of a backward crouch now, and perhaps that is why so much that is bad in humanity seems to be driven to the surface, so that to some the world appears at present to be deteriorating. All this happens so slowly to us that at times we do not realize that there is progress. The laws of rebirth and karma work hand in glove, so to speak. We are told that mankind came into being because spirit, or the life force behind everything, wished to develop more creative power. This development could only be accomplished by spirit being so imprisoned and confined in matter flesh it forgets that oneness with wisdom and has to find everything out afresh through frightening experience, or rather through fighting and experience. We are told that virgin spirit divided itself up into fractions, and by ensouling the egos of man and all other forms of life, sank itself into the heavy imprisoning matter of this world, and is slowly and patiently fighting its way back to truth and light and power. And the human ego is evolved steadily, each undergoing constant rebirth, until it gradually attains to a knowledge of the laws of the universe through karma, or the effect of its own acts and thoughts, achieving power and strength through the mastery of one law, another, until at last it reaches omnipotence through both physical and spiritual. And we might say that the friction between the opposite poles of spirit and flesh causes, as an electricity, light or energy, which is creative force power. The planets and earth, races of mankind, the animal, vegetable, and mineral kingdoms also reincarnate, all being under the same law. We must mention here that it is not possible, according to the secret teaching, for man to be reborn as an animal, because however low he might sink in his own kingdom, he could not retrogress into a slower vibration. This theory, called transmigration of souls, is held by certain peoples who have allowed their former knowledge to become distorted. Many persons here in the West find it rather difficult to accept this theory of reincarnation because it has been stamped out for thousands of years. It therefore requires a great deal of accustomed mental exercise to obtain a real picture of it to hold in our mind. And in it, it is accepted quite naturally by most of the Eastern peoples, and has been for untold centuries. So that whether we believe in it or not, we should go into the theory as fairly and impartially as if we are studying their ideas on art or agriculture. As a rule, human beings are unable to remember anything about their past lives they may have had. Of course, there are exceptions, and many people have collected a great deal of evidence of such memories, which evidence is extremely interesting. In fact, I think we should find it impossible to deny that some people at least have lived before. And when we consider that we are unable to remember a great deal of our present life, especially things which have affected our character deeply, until they are laid bare by a psychoanalyst, it is not surprising if we do not remember past lives. But we are told that the experience gained in such lives is retained by us in those qualities which we describe as having a conscience, an instinct, or a knack. And I think that's kind of true, and that's how we identify ourselves and our personalities, and And as every time we seem to have these insights or abilities that we don't know how, like, for instance, I had a natural ability for music, a natural love for music and different types of instruments and so on. And I had a natural ability to write. I had a natural ability to create, and a natural love to read and read about certain things and discover certain things and get in commune with certain spirits that seemed to be ancient and friendly to me over the many, many years of my life. And I realized only in probably the last 10 years have I realized who and what I am to be, or am, I should say. I think George Orwell said, the man in the mirror, when you reach 50, the man in the mirror is who you are. Okay? And since I've reached 50 a while back, I have to agree with that. You are who you see in the mirror. And sometimes that can frighten me. Sometimes it frightens me, especially in the morning. But first thing in the morning. But, I can wash up and shave and put on deodorant. And next thing you know, look and feel like $1 million. And that's the way I feel like. That's what I feel like. And so if you can adapt to that, and if you can arrange your mind that early in the morning to accept who you are, the greatness in you, whether you're great or not, it doesn't necessarily matter. It's in your mind, it's in your mind's eye, that you will be, or that you are, that exists now. And for that, you're a better person for it. Something happened here. I lost my page. Anyway. Oh, I see what happened. Okay, they disconnected my show here. No. My switchboard. Hoping it comes back. It appears that I'm still running. Connection to zero is reset. Network link was interrupted while negotiating a connection. Please try again. Alright, let's try again. Never seems to work when you do that, but didn't work then either. Okay. So anyway, we're at the end of the show. I want to thank everybody for joining me tonight. Hoping I can get back to the switchboard, but it doesn't look like the switchboard wants to cooperate here. No. Not cooperating. Okay. Well, again, it's 9:01. And we've done a lot of damage tonight, so I think we'll stop right there. And I hope you enjoyed the show. Hope to tell your friends to listen. And we'll talk to you tomorrow, I believe, tomorrow night. Let me just see if I have an episode coming up tomorrow with George Dixon. I think we had one last week, but I'm not sure. Of course, there's a problem with my Blog Talk Radio thing here. Doesn't seem to be responding to anything. Yeah. That's great. Okay. I can't tell if we're still on, I can't tell if we're still recording, and I can't tell you what's going on tomorrow, but I can tell you to just look at our upcoming programs right here on the station here. And it'll tell you if we're on the next times we're on. And for some reason, I can't seem to properly upload this thing. It just doesn't seem to want to work. Come on. Looks like we're having some problems here, computer problems there with the site, with Blog Talk. It just doesn't seem to be responding. So I'm going to leave it there for tonight. And I want to thank you, thank everybody for joining me. And again, look at the upcoming shows when we're next on. And thanks. And I'm not certain if we're going to be on tomorrow night, but if we are, We'll be right here. And I want to thank you, and have a pleasant evening. Good night.